Wine Emporium in Urbana. This Saturday, June 25th from 2 to 6 p.m., the Corkscrew is hosting Oregon winemaker Peter Rosbeck of Chenaan Winery for a tasting of Peter's wines. Then from 8 to 10, live jazz and pop music with the Salamanders. Information at 337-7704.
This is Jay Pierce, station manager of WILL Radio. This week, the U.S. House of Representatives will vote on a bill that would cut federal funding for public broadcasting by 45%. This cut would cost WILL Radio as much as $183,000. WILL Television would be cut even more. Many of you have called your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. If you haven't yet done so, there's still time. It's very important that they hear what you think about cuts to WILL's federal funding. You'll find the phone numbers of your members of Congress on our website, will.uiuc.edu, or call us at 217-333-1070. Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, AM 580, and online at will.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll talk with a journalist who has worked for the World Food Program of the UN as a relief worker in Africa. We'll talk with him about the challenges of the work, its dangers, and what motivates people to serve. Our guest is John Burnett. He is the author of Where Soldiers Fear to Tread, a relief worker's tale of survival. Burnett says relief workers are as likely to be killed in the line of their civilian duties as are well-trained and well-armed soldiers. He points out that more UN aid workers have been killed in the past 5 years than peacekeepers. Death, it may come at the hands of a child soldier. John Burnett served in Somalia during the flood relief operations from 1997 to 1998. And at the opening of Where Soldiers Fear to Tread, readers find Burnett and his driver in Somalia confronted with a child soldier. The boy has a gun jammed into the face of the driver. Burnett says in the few weeks of serving as a relief worker in Somalia, a nation rent by a decade of anarchy, I have come to fear children with guns. It is one thing to face an adult with a full load, but children, unlike grown-ups, do not have a personal history to balance, to offset the matter of fact, to work out anything rational. Few adults, no matter how experienced, know how to persuade a child not to shoot. If killing is what he knows, and 10 years of war is a long time to a 10-year-old carrying a gun, then there is little chance for reasoning, any one-on-one communication. Cock it, shoot it, next. That's from the opening of Where Soldiers Fear to Tread. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. John Burnett is a former reporter for United Press International. He has written for National Geographic, The Guardian, and The New York Times. He is also the author of Dangerous Waters, Modern Piracy and Terror on the High Seas. His new book, Where Soldiers Fear to Tread, is published by Bantam Books. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. John Burnett, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Happy to be there with you.
When did you arrive in Somalia, and what was the situation when you arrived?
Well, the situation when I arrived was very much like the situation as it is today, and like the situation was when the Delta Force went in Mogadishu in 91 and 92. Pure anarchy. You see more guns, and then you see normal life. Everyone has a gun, everyone has a Kalashnikov, and it is quite easy for... You have feuding warlords who are going after certain turf, an airport or a port, and it's as close to classic anarchy as you can imagine. I got there in '97, late '97, and worked into sometime into '98, and it was during a flood relief. El Nino had spawned some pretty horrific rains in Ethiopia, and then it washed out, came down the rivers and washed out some of the fertile land in Somalia, leaving another humanitarian crisis. And so that's how it all began.
Mm. What was your assignment?
My assignment was to the UN at the time. It was what they call a humanitarian emergency, which is the way of saying that something has happened, and there are a lot of people, millions that are going to be refugees, that are homeless, and that are dying. The rains had caused this fertile area to be washed away, and the UN was hiring basically people off the streets with any maritime experience. And I was a former merchant seaman, and had a sailboat in Kenya. Had sailed to Kenya, and answered a fax for this plea for help delivering food up these swollen rivers and into the floodplain on these little boats. I might add that the boats were donated by the Norwegian government, built in Finland, and they were speedboats used for water skiing. So they were pretty pretty useless as boats to deliver supplies, emergency supplies, and to rescue women and children out of the trees as the crocodiles were snapping at them. I mean, this is a real life event, and the job is, as I joined with many others or a few others to rescue these people and to deliver food on these speedboats.
Yeah. When you signed on, you were asked if you had gear, and you said not much. I wasn't sure what I would need, and the logistics officer in turn says, "Well, to tell you the truth, neither are we." And later, you're asked, "Are there?" You ask, "Are there flak jackets?" Because you're preparing to go upriver on this boat, and you're going to have people. There's a real potential for people on both sides of the river to be shooting at you.
The problem was that they wanted me to go up alone, delivering some relief supplies between two feuding warlords, and the so-called green line, the demarcation line between these two clans, was the river. So I was to go up the river, delivering these supplies to the starving and to the stranded on little islands as the water was rising between these two clans, and basically was a carnival a shooting target, you know, like you'd see at the Illinois State Fair, which I know very well. You plink with a .22 and or an air gun, and the little bear rises up and falls back down, and that's basically what they had me do. And so when I asked for a flak jacket, there was some good reason, but I got a lot of stick from it, because they said, well, if you need a flak jacket going up the river, then maybe you don't belong in this job. And that was the time I realized that I probably didn't belong in the job.
Yeah, all in a day's work.
Yeah.
What were you supplied with?
Virtually nothing. I had to beg for a UN combat helmet, one of those blue helmets, and they gave me a flak jacket finally, and that weighed. It wasn't one of those nifty little Kevlar jobs, or even the more modern ones. It was one of those World War II lead-lined suits of mail that weighed close to 40 pounds. And driving the speedboat carrying supplies up the river, if I had fallen overboard or been shot, I would have gone right down into the bottom.
Mm.
Otherwise than that, I wasn't supplied with anything. Just like, you signed up for a job, and Celeste, you know, the point. This what I wrote here was I don't know if you ever tried to write down a nightmare, but this was a nightmare, and I've written it down. One reviewer said that this book gave him nightmares. Well, it's a nightmare that not only I live, but hundreds of relief workers, humanitarian workers, live on a daily basis, whether you're in Iraq or Afghanistan or Somalia or Nepal or Uganda or Angola. These are places, these relief workers go as the book says, where soldiers fear to tread. Well, no soldiers want to fear to tread, but the politicians who send the soldiers won't send the soldiers. I mean, we won't send soldiers back to Somalia, so, but they'll send relief workers, unarmed civilians, into these god-awful hostile places. And I'm glad I went, because I think I saved a few lives, and was also, I'm afraid, responsible for the death of someone, of a small child. What the nightmares that are in this book are no more startling than those are lived by other relief workers elsewhere.
Yeah. What's it like today to talk about this?
It's a little difficult, frankly.
Yeah.
I wrote this as sort of a cathartic. I wrote it immediately after. There's some things in the book that I did not put in. When I landed back in Nairobi, I had a plane crash and walked away from that, and then disappeared for 3 weeks into the bush with a typewriter and wrote it all down. And there's this post-traumatic syndrome that relief workers go through, like firefighters, like those at 9/11 and at the World Trade Center. You go through a withdrawal and an anger and a resentment and a disassociation that's really hard to explain. And relief workers are no different than firefighters, but or anyone who risked their lives to help people. And the only thing that gripes me a little bit, frankly, is that they're just, I mean, to me, these guys, not me, but the people who are out there in Afghanistan, the Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders people, the Red Cross, the World Vision people, these are the people that risk their lives to save people. You know, they expect to go out to feed and to heal, relocate, immunize, build schools, and teach in some of the most hostile places on earth. They don't expect to get raped and kidnapped or beaten up or murdered just doing their civilian jobs, and this is what's happening. So I'm glad I wrote the book, because it's something that must be said. And the book's not a very pleasant book, I'm afraid. It's exciting, but it's a difficult book to have written.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult book to read, but I thank you for writing it. And I thank you for talking with us this afternoon. You know, you and your fellow workers joked, you know, you were mercenaries, missionaries, maniacs. Who does this work, and what motivates them to do it?
That's a good question. I'm not sure what the hell motivates anybody to do anything. When you're out there, you're just an ordinary guy doing, and there are a lot of women out there who are doing the same sort of things. From all nationalities, many Americans, many Brits, many French, many Dutch, they're all there in the same boiling pot. And what motivates us, you're right, are we missionaries or maniacs or mercenaries? Some of us, I went in there, I didn't go in there for any altruistic motives. I went in there because it paid pretty good. And I was having some problems with my wife, and so it was a kind of a French Foreign Legion for me. And it was another adventure, and I'm sort of addicted to adventure, which is not a very salutatious thing to say, but that's the way it is. And so I went in there because I didn't go in there to save anybody. Other people went in there for the money. When I was in Baghdad, just before the UN compound was bombed, one of the an Australian girl who was a school teacher said that she was in it for the adrenaline rush. So what takes you in there? Who knows? But these were just normal, ordinary. These aren't weird people. These aren't people who and a lot of people go in there. I must say, Celeste, that many people go in there because they go in there for true and pure altruism. They feel that they're making a difference. They want to save lives and they want to help people. But I couldn't put a percentage on how many people are altruists, true altruists, and how many people are in there for the adventure, and how many people are in there for other reasons. It's very difficult. But as you have a vast sway of personalities, you have the same different motivations.
Mm. How long do people stay in the field? Why do they stay?
Yeah, they stay in the field. It's like being in a war. It is being in a war zone, and there is certain addiction to that adrenal rush. I mean, the first time that I was shot at, I was scared to death. Second time, I was scared. Third time, well, as long as the bullets weren't being shot at me, then I could I winced, I jumped, but I didn't duck. And oftentimes, when you duck into the bullet. A lot of these, they don't really try to, in Somalia, at least where I was, they weren't trying to shoot you. But there were so many bullets going around that you often ran into a bullet by mistake. And but in Afghanistan now, and in Iraq, and in so many places of the world today, the humanitarian workers are being targeted. And we weren't targeted. We were kidnapped. We were abused. We were beat up. But we were never targeted as we were not targets of murder. But today, I'm afraid that's what it is.
Yeah. Well, this work has always been dangerous, and now it, as you just said, it seems it's become more dangerous. Why?
Well, it seems to me that in the last 2 years it has become open season for humanitarian workers. The number of humanitarian workers that have been killed in the last 24 months is it breaks all records. But then you have places like to shoot a relief worker is to make a political statement. I mean, let's face it, American policy is not highly regarded in many places in the world, especially where relief work is performed. I mean, we were very nervous in Somalia because it was shortly after the debacle in Mogadishu, in which I think 14 American soldiers were killed in that ambush. So we were worried there. But now it's basically open season. If you're a relief worker, then by shooting a relief worker, you are making a statement that you are an intruder, you're an interloper, you don't belong here. You represent the West, and chances are you represent infidels and infidels policy, which is the American policy. And a year ago this June, five Doctors Without Borders employees, including three doctors, were killed in Afghanistan because they were considered by the returning Taliban to be American spies. Well, that of course is ludicrous. But the perception that relief workers, that humanitarian workers, represent some country's political and military agenda is widespread, and it's increasing. And to shoot a relief worker is every bit as impressive to the world as shooting a soldier.
Hmm. How does an aid agency make that decision to end an operation?
The Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, left Afghanistan after 24 years. They worked in Afghanistan healing, basically, and immunizing and saving lives for 24 years through the worst of times, through the Taliban restrictions and the Soviet occupation, and they were able to do their work without being targeted. We came in. And the coalition came in after Osama bin Laden and changed the landscape. And now anyone who represents the West, no matter what good they're doing, is a target. And I think, as I wrote in the New York Times just recently, that as long as anyone believes that relief workers are representative of a nation's political and military agendas, they're going to be targeted. And I don't see now any change. I think relief work is completely changed, completely different than it was. I mean, the UN or the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders or any of the other organizations went in to save lives. Now what they're doing is ducking these bullets.
Can this situation be turned around?
I don't think so. I think humanitarian relief work, as we have known it in the past 40, 50, 60 years, since the Red Cross first started in World War One, I think that there is now we'll never see humanitarian work be the same again, and I think it's ever going to be turned around. I mean, now you we all know that, and I see it from this side of the pond, but we all know that this conflict between Islam and the rest of the world is going to be a long ongoing situation. We got a lot of hotheads, a lot of suicide nutcases, who are the unemployed and the poverty stricken, who've got nothing better to do than to become a jihadist and target anything that represents the other side of the world.
Mm. So, what of the people of the world who need aid? People like the driver I mentioned at the outset of the program, who has this gun in his face, but he is a man who is hoping, he was hoping for children, hoping for a life. He had a wife. He's, you know, what, and at the end of your book, you know, you point out that, you know, this operation, for all its ups and downs, tens of thousands of people were fed, thousands of lives were saved.
So, yeah, you saved lives. You know, I think the debt relief program that Tony Blair and George Bush have finally agreed to is very important. There are lives to be saved. I mean, of course, we in America should save some of the lives that we have on the streets with an equal amount of compassion, but you know, we've got to there's a lot of good being done, but the conundrum here is whether, if it's the UN or the Red Cross, the UN and the Red Cross both left Iraq after their compounds were bombed, and the conundrum is that, do you ask the military, the foreign military, to protect you, or do you say we don't want your protection because we don't represent the United States, we don't represent Great Britain, we are neutral? And relief work is enshrined in international law. Relief work is neutral, but if you're in a dangerous place and you ask for protection from American troops, then you are perforce a part of that. You're aligning yourself with that policy, that military policy. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any. There's just no way out of that. When I was unloading a helicopter in a very small patch of dry land, I was unloading 50 kilo bags of flour that had the clasped hands of Uncle Sam and the logo of the American flag and the letters or the sentence "Gift of the People of the United States of America." Well, you know, this was just after, as I say, just after Mogadishu, and the Somalis have long memories, and you know, they were looking at us and saying, well, we'll accept your aid, but damn, we'd sure like to have you get the hell out of our country. You just knew, and I was a neutral. I mean, as an American working for a neutral release agency, I was a neutral, and I wasn't representing a release policy. But you do have this problem of when you deliver aid, for example, and you give a bag full of flour that has the American flag on it, then you are really delivering these supplies as a gift of the United States, and therefore you are representing the United States. But a relief worker doesn't want to be that way. The relief worker just wants to do the job, save some lives, not represent any policy, and get the hell out.
Hmm. Do you think people in leadership positions at the in the federal government in the United States are aware of this problem in terms of what it
would? Yeah, good question, Celeste. Absolutely, they're aware of it. Andrew Natsios, who is the head of the USAID, Agency for International Development, told a large group of aid organizations in a year and a half ago, saying that if you want to distribute American aid and you want our support, then you have to be you represent American policy. And if you don't do a better job at representing American policy, then I'm going to tear up your contracts, and you won't deliver it. Well, these independent aid organizations, of course, rely on the distribution, not so much the money, but the donations of countries like the United States. And the United States is the largest donor of emergency supplies in the world. Now, that's not to say that it's the largest donor of aid. Of foreign aid, because that's not true, but it is the largest donor of emergency aid. In other words, when there's a crisis, we stand stock solid, and the aid is there. Colin Powell, after the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, told relief workers that they're part of the American combat team. Well, that just sent shivers through the neutral humanitarian relief efforts, because no one wants to be a part of anybody's combat team. All we want to do is to go out there and save lives. That's not a big thing to ask, and it's a hell of a sacrifice in the individuals. We sure don't want to be. Relief workers, humanitarian workers, are unarmed. They're civilians. They're not soldiers. And so when somebody says, well, you are part of the American combat effort, then that's a bad dream, because you know now if you're part of the American combat effort and you go into Afghanistan, you're going to get killed.
Hmm. Some people would say, you know, we're in a fight for people's hearts and minds. And so that's why we say you're part of the team. What do you say?
Well, but Colin Powell didn't have to say the combat team.
Mm.
He didn't have to say. He said, if he had defined it in such a way that, I personally, and an admirer of Colin Powell, I don't think he personally meant as part of the combat team. I think as part of the team to combat, but it was worded in such a way that most international relief organizations just blanched. That was the worst thing that they could have heard, and the last thing they wanted to hear. The fighting the war on terrorism is well and good, but there's still a war on poverty, there's a war on hunger, there's a war on disease, there's the efforts to stop mining. There's the efforts to put an end to child soldiers, just from malaria. I mean, hell, you know, a child dies from malaria every 30 seconds. I mean, this is a child under five dies every 30 seconds from malaria. This is, and all they need are mosquito nets, bed nets coated with mosquito repellent, and it costs bugger all, and it's very easy to provide. But no one's doing it, or we are very, very slow in providing it.
Hmm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, John Burnett. He's a journalist. He served in Somalia during the flood relief operations from 1997 to 1998 as part of the United Nations World Food Program. He has written a book about his experience in Somalia, Where Soldiers Feared to Tread, a relief worker's tale of survival. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. We look forward to hearing from you. Your questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Let's talk about some of the people that you served with in the World Food Program. Maybe you would tell us first about Russ Ulrey.
Well, he's a true humanitarian. He's gone through, Russ has gone through more wars as a civilian than anyone I've ever seen. He was there in Somalia and Mogadishu before the Americans landed. He's been in Sudan before Darfur, Afghanistan. This is the one who puts together these emergency programs puts together the logistics for these humanitarian crises. When there's a crisis, he's usually called to put together the program to put the fires out. And he's a bit of a curmudgeon, but very thorough at what he does, and quite frustrated at the bureaucratic still there? Sorry.
Yes, we're still here.
He's quite frustrated at the internecine squabbles between various agencies, just to get the donor nation funds and supplies.
Yeah, that's one. That's interesting. One of the problems that you write about is the divide in other agencies aside. The divide in operational mandates between the various arms of the United Nations. Maybe you'd talk about that a bit.
Yeah, it's good. It really surprised me. I had no idea. I, like most people, I thought that a humanitarian relief effort went very smoothly. Everybody's working. The cogs are moving very smoothly. But in the initial phases, you have these competing agencies, and within the UN, which is what I hope this new reform program will take care of. You had these competing agencies. Who you had UNICEF, UNHCR, which is the relief agency, WFP, which is the World Food Program, UNDP, which is the UN Development Program. You had so many of these different agencies competing for the affections and love and loyalty and funds of the donor nations, and the competition seemed to the competition slowed things down considerably. But people like Russ would bypass it. You know, if you got a lot of crap coming your way, then you just go someplace where it's a little cleaner, and you go and do the job that way. And that's what he did. That's why he was such a brilliant coordinator of these programs. But there is, a few people realize that there's a little war going on within the agencies themselves. I mean, CARE would battle the Red Cross. The Red Cross would battle the Doctors Without Borders and for the television cameras. Here you have people starving, dying, flies flying around the distended stomachs of these poor children. And you would have relief agencies, relief workers walking around with T-shirts that says CARE, Red Cross, World Vision, World Food Program, and so that they could be seen by the cameras. It's a small point, because relief workers go out there and they do their job. They do their jobs. There's no doubt about that. So when I mention that, that's sort of an aside. It's not common, but it happens.
Yeah.
And of course, the greater the publicity, the greater the exposure, then a donor nation, for example, will say, well, let's throw $30 million to this agency to do the job.
Well, it moves the story also from the back of the paper to the front pages.
Well, Let's talk about the front pages. You know, this is an issue that I'm bringing up that you didn't ask. But, you know, you have the relief workers, humanitarian workers are civilians, and they get killed. And you know, if a volunteer soldier goes to a country and this soldier is trained to kill, he comes back in a body bag and he's treated as a hero. An American relief worker, a civilian, gets killed trying to save lives, And she comes back in a body bag, and no one gives a damn. And so this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I realized that not only I was out there, but so many of my colleagues were out there getting beat up and kidnapped and raped and murdered, and no one gives a damn. And yet they're the ones out there trying to save lives. And I don't fault a soldier coming back in a body bag and being treated as a hero. But what I'm saying is that we've got to realize that there are other people out there who are fighting just as hard, who are in just as dangerous a situation. In fact, oftentimes much more dangerous, because there are no soldiers there to protect them. Like when I was in Somalia, there were no soldiers there. No soldiers wanted to go there. No soldiers would be sent there. But they sent us civilians. I met one of the women I was working with was murdered by a child soldier, and that is not something that ever makes the newspapers.
Yeah, is that Saskia?
I've got on my soapbox. That's my soapbox for the day. Sorry.
Tell us about that woman, Saskia von Meyenfeld.
Yeah, Saskia, what a wonderful woman. She was a young woman who did a lot of who was in it totally. Purely for altruism, just because she wanted to help. She had a sort of an adventurous streak in her, but she was running logistics in Somalia, and then she was sent to Burundi. And this is what we run into. We run into child soldiers, and she was in a convoy that was went to a refugee camp. They were sussing out the refugee camp and found that. The refugee camp was run by rebels in Burundi. The rebels lined them up, lined nine of the UN staffers up against the truck, and blindfolded them and threatened to kill them. And then took the blindfolds off. One of the young boys with a gun played around with Saskia's glasses, and pranced around and danced like a clown. And then gave Saskia her glasses back, and they thought that that was it, and they were relieved. The child. Who was probably about between 9 and 11, as he's walking with his mates away from the UN workers, suddenly turned around and said, "Why should they be permitted to live?" And emptied his Kalashnikov at two of them, including Saskia, and killing Saskia immediately. And that was pretty miserable news. But it wasn't unexpected in this line of work. But you know. When these child soldiers have no way of dealing with a child soldier, and you don't know what triggers them, what's going to set them off, and what's going to cause them to pull the trigger.
Let's take a call. A listener is waiting to talk with us. Caller in Urbana, line one. You're on the air with John Burnett.
Yeah, this is a very interesting topic. I had two questions. One is, I saw that Angelina Jolie movie, Beyond Borders, and I was kind of curious if you had any kind of criticism of it. I kind of liked it because it gave kind of an emotional connection to the work and, you know, kind of made you visualize what might really happen out there. And then my second question is, I've always heard that the U.S. aid through the AID, the Agency for International Development, was always done in terms of vouchers that could only be converted into American-made goods and services. And is that true?
Yeah. Okay. First, about the I didn't see the movie that you referred to. I've heard about it, but if there was an emotional connection between herself and those who she was who was saving, there's I'm an ex-journalist, and I've covered a lot of unpleasantness in, as a reporter, As a reporter, you go into a place like this with this emotional disconnect. You know, like I'm just there observing and doing my job, and nothing affects me. It doesn't take very long before you are completely and totally immersed in their plight. There is no longer any emotional disconnect there. You are certainly involved in it, and there were times that that I cried, not I mean at, in the frustration and in the inability to be able to do something to help a person, either because of the bureaucracy or because of logistics. A plane wasn't there, and a person died in my arms. There's just emotionally, you get very emotional about it, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. As far as the USAID, yes, I think that's correct about the vouchers. But the real problem with USAID donations is the fact that when we distribute it, it says USAID and has America emblazoned all over those bags, and therefore it makes everyone think that we are. As soon as our back is turned, they'll accept the aid, but shoot us in the back. And whereas most people that we're helping and saving don't feel that way, or would never do something like that, you know that there is that feeling. And this isn't paranoia. I mean, it's written about. It is what got those Doctors Without Borders doctors killed in Afghanistan. They are known to be part of a policy that and you know, whether you believe in the policy or not, when you're out there giving aid, you're neutral, and that's what I mean. As I say, it's enshrined in international law. It's part of the UN. Constitution, but it's part of the. It is law, and it is up to the host government to protect these people.
Yeah, it's a shame about the conflating of those people trying to do relief and those people who engage in political efforts. But you can't blame people for thinking that, given our history of using any means available. You know, it'd be kind of surprising that our intelligence agencies wouldn't try to. Turn people in who are trying to do just a strictly neutral job, you know, into making them report and making them, you know, promote things that are more political. Thanks for writing.
Well, you're quite right. It's a very good point, and you're absolutely right. And it's a damn difficult thing to be a relief worker, especially today.
Well, thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We only have about a minute or two left, John. Is there anything else you want to say before we have to wrap up?
No. Just that. I mean, I've enjoyed this is one of the first real very good interviews I've had, because it allowed me to express this great frustration about humanitarian workers and the fact that. They go out there and expect to do everything, and they don't expect to get killed for doing it. And the book is as I say, it's a series of running nightmares you don't have to know about relief work to be scared by this book. But I'm glad to have written, and I'm glad to have been on your show.
It's been my pleasure to have you, and I think the book is very important. What kind of reaction has it gotten to date?
Well, it's doing very well, and I leave. It's published in of all places in mainland China and the Netherlands and Germany. But I leave in a couple of days for an author's tour in the United Kingdom, and they expect it to do quite well there too. So it's selling very well in Canada. People, you see, the problem is that most people. People in America don't care about Somalia, they don't care about relief work, and they don't seem to care much about things outside their own purview. And it's selling much better in Canada and in the Netherlands and in Germany and in the UK than it is in America, in the United States, simply because people don't want to read another Somali book. But it's not a book about Somalia. It's a book that deals with what we, as relief workers, go through daily, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah. A few minutes ago, you referred to yourself as an ex-journalist. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm working on a farm. I now have lived for the last short time here in Switzerland, and it's haying season, and I'm helping the local farmer suddenly died, and so I'm helping his wife and one son do the haying, and sitting and putting together another project. Mm. So it's really good to be out in the out in the fields and out of the country.
Yeah.
I used to work for United Press International covering the legislature in Springfield, in right in your backyard, and that was some of the most pleasant years of my life in Illinois. And but those were some years ago. That was during the bedsheet ballot for the at-large election, and Governor Kerner and Richard Daley and Paul Powell with the money in the shoeboxes. And so that dates me a bit, but I tell you, I've got a lot of good memories about Champaign-Urbana and Springfield.
Thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon. I've really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit, and thank you again for writing Where Soldiers Fear to Tread.
Well, I hope I wasn't too emotional for your listeners, but it was a pleasure talking to you, Celeste.
I understand completely. John Burnett has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He is the author of Where Soldiers Fear to Tread, a relief worker's tale of survival. The book is published by Bantam Books. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, after rallying fairly sharply higher today in the bean pit, futures settled about a penny and three quarters higher in the nearby July contract. November contract was up 1 cent. The September was unchanged for the day. But they did rally to 752 in that July contract for the beans. Settlement price there at 737. It was a penny and three quarters higher. So a pretty good run up, settled back down, waiting on more weather forecast and all sorts of things. By the way, in the bean pit, and I'll tell you more about this during the closing market report today, and certainly a lot more tomorrow. Kevin Steffi stopped me on my way over here this afternoon and said, Todd, we need to talk because we've got to discuss more on the two-spotted spider mite tomorrow after, or rather tomorrow morning. I'll take a trip down to Tolono, which is south of Champaign. He says it's exploding at least there, and I think in a pretty good shot across the state of Illinois. So if you haven't and you're a farmer scouted, at least in the weeds and the edges of the field for two-spotted spider mite, you probably ought to do that. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little later during the closing market report for the day, and we'll do it again tomorrow when we actually have Kevin Steffi on. July wheat futures now for the day, 342 the high, the low at 335. Settlement price there at 336. And they were up one for the day. September contract, 353, the high, the low at 345 and a quarter. Settlement prices, September wheat at 345 and three quarters. Three quarters higher. December futures, 364, the high, the low at 357. Settled $3.58 and a quarter cents, up a penny and three quarters. In the March contract, at 373 high, low at 368 and a half. A settlement at 369 and a quarter, up one and three quarters. And May futures, 375, the high, the low at 370. Settlement price at $3.72. And they were up two for the day. I suppose I ought to tell you who Kevin Steffi is. Most of the farmers will know. He's the entomologist here at the University of Illinois. He works for Extension. July corn, 236 and a half, the high, the low at 228 and a half. Settlement price, 229 and a half, down two and three quarters for the day. September futures, 246 and a quarter, the high, the low at 238. Settlement price, 238 and three quarters, down three and a quarter for the day. December contract, 256 and a half on the high, the low at 48 and a quarter. Settled $2.49 and three quarters, down two and a half for the day. And the March futures, 263, the high, the low at 256. Settled 256 and a half, down two and a half in the May contract. 265 and a half high, low at 258 and a half. Settled 258 and a half, down two and a half. July futures, 267 and three quarters, the high, the low at 261 and one quarter. And settled at 261 and a half. They were off three and a half for the day. July oats now 154 and a half, the high, the low at 148 and three quarters, settled 149 and three quarters, down three and three quarters on the day, and September futures off 4 cents, 154 and three quarters the settlement price for the September oats, with a high of 160 and a quarter and a low at $1.54 a bushel. From the soy complex, July soybeans 752 and a quarter, the high, the low at $7.33. Settled 737. They were up a penny and three quarters. August were up 1 cent for the day. That contract had a high of 755, a low at 37, and an August settlement price at $7.40. Once again, a penny higher. September futures, 760 the high. The low at 742. Settlement price at 744.5. Unchanged in the November's. 770 the high. The low at 750.5. Settled 754. They were up one. January contract in the bean pit. 770 the high there. 752 the low. And the settlement at 755. They were a half higher. And the March contract up 2.5 cents today. 746.5 the settlement price, with a high of 754.5 and a low at $7.42. July bean meal now. 236.80 the high, the low at 230.20, settled 230.70. They were 90 lower. August meal, 237.50 the high, the low at 231.30, settled 231.60, down 80. July bean oil down 12, 25.70 on the high, the low at 27, and the settlement price at 25.32. And the August bean oil, 25.82 the high, the low at 25.37, settlement there at 25.40, was down 16. Now here's Celeste with numbers from the Merck.
Okay, let's start with feeder cattle. August feeder cattle, 108.92.5 the high, the low 108 even, the settlement 108.80, that up 25. September 107.75 the high, 106.95 the low, 107.70 the settlement, that up 15. October 106.55 the high, 105.97.5 the low, the settlement 106.50, that down 2.5. June live cattle, 82.22.5 the high, the low 81.35, the settlement 82.05, that up 32.5. August 80.40 the high, 79.52.5 the low, the settlement 80 even, that finished up 27.5. July lean hog, 66.65 the high, 65.55 the low, finishing at 66.12.5, up 2.5. August 65.75 the high, 64.62.5 the low, 64.80 the settlement, that down 65. October lean hogs 55.75 the high, 54.67.5 the low, the settlement 54.80, that down 92.5. December lean hogs 54.10 the high today, the low 52.90, finishing at 53 even, down 102.5. And July bellies 63.50 the high, the low 61.70, the settlement 61.80, that finishing down 195. The Dow, it is, let's see if I can find it here on the screen. Just when you thought it was there, it disappeared. Well, I can't tell you that at the moment. Let's bring up another screen. The Dow currently down 5 points at 10,595. The S&P 500 is up 1 point at 1215, and I don't have the NASDAQ for you at this moment.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his